This episode of The Y-Files is brought to you by PDS Debt. Gather round. This happened in Madrid in July 2008. When Lorena woke up, the first thing she noticed were the sheets. They weren't hers. She put new beige sheets on the bed last night, but these were blue. She didn't own blue sheets. She was still half asleep. Maybe she got the colors mixed up. She didn't have time to worry about it. She had to get to work. Lorena didn't know the sheets were just the first clue that her entire reality was about to unravel.
Quiet on the set. We are rolling.
What set? What are you talking about?
Well, I'm making a major motion picture in the backyard. It's called Jaws 6. This time it's personal. Written, directed, produced, and starring yours truly as the shark and the hero. It's a dual role. Very Daniel Day-Lewis.
How can you be the shark and the guy fighting the shark?
It's called range, human. Look it up. The Beaver Brothers built a great set. They rearranged your deck furniture into a coastal New England fishing village. Very authentic. Wyatt nailed the lighthouse.
That's my patio umbrella.
No, it's a beacon of hope for a town under siege. Oh, I even hired a stunt double. Very experienced. His name's Derek. Found him at the grocery store. Sardine. Absolute unit.
You hired a dead sardine as your stunt double.
He's not dead. He's method. He hasn't moved in 2 days. That's commitment.
No, that's rigor mortis.
Agree to disagree. The point is, Derek's SAG eligible, and his $8,000 day rate is very reasonable.
What?
Oh, Gertie's my fog machine. She breathes heavy near a humidifier and chef's kiss instant atmosphere. Hear that? That's Oscar-winning fog right there.
That sounds like a camel having an asthma attack.
It's ambience, human.
Okay, how much did all this cost?
Well, craft services alone was 11 grand. You'd be amazed what beavers eat. Wyatt put away 6 rotisserie chickens in a single take. And we did 47 takes. Then Morgan and Virgil ate the table. The Teamsters were pissed. But now the caterer's threatening to sue. Derek's agent wants residuals. And Gertie's fogged up your neighbor's kitchen window. Now they think their house is haunted.
Yep. It sounds like you need PDS debt.
Oh, did you just roll credits into today's sponsor?
Sure did.
It starts small. A bill you can't pay, then another. Suddenly, your mailbox is full of final notices. Your phone won't stop ringing. You don't answer, but you know who it is. Debt collectors. They want your car, your home, your paycheck, your peace. And if you're carrying any balance on your credit cards right now, it's costing you money every single day you wait. Debt doesn't wait. It destroys. But there's a way out. PDS Debt has helped hundreds of thousands escape before it was too late. They use AI and data to go beyond the numbers, to understand your unique situation and build a personalized plan that actually works. No cookie-cutter solution, just one lower monthly payment and a clear path to becoming debt-free. And here's what makes them different. Zero credit impact. Getting help won't hurt your score. There's no minimum credit score required either. Whether your credit is bad or fair, PDS Debt helps you save more, pay off debt faster, and start putting money back in your pocket. They're the top-rated company in the industry, A-plus rated by the BBB and thousands of 5-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. That's not marketing. That's proof. We've all been there. Debt is overwhelming. The interest piles up and you feel stuck. If you're dealing with credit card debt, personal loans, medical bills, or collections, don't wait. The moment you complete your assessment, the savings start. Stop living in debt. Get your free 30-second personalized assessment today at pdsdebt.com/files. You're just 30 seconds away from your first step toward financial freedom.
pdsdebt.com/files.
That's right.
Perfect. Now I'm already writing a sequel. Jaws 7, 8, 9. You see what I did there?
Sequel? You haven't finished the first one.
That's pre-production talk, human. Think bigger. I'm building the HCU. Hecklefish Cinematic Universe.
I get it.
See you at Sundance. Ciao.
Lorena got up and started her morning routine on autopilot, but small things kept catching her attention. Her favorite shirt wasn't in her closet. A coffee mug was in the wrong cabinet. The bathroom towels were folded differently. She found it odd, but didn't give it much thought. Maybe she put the mug in the wrong place. Maybe the shirt's still at the cleaners. Everything else seemed fine. She finished her coffee, showered, and headed out for work. In the parking lot, her car wasn't there. Someone else was in her space. She clicked the car alarm and heard a beep from the other side of the lot. She never parked on that side of the building. So either someone moved the car, or she stopped herself from thinking about it. At work, she saw a couple of new faces. New hires, she figured. But one of them said, "Good morning, Larina." Like, he knew her. She didn't recognize him, but she said good morning anyway. She got to her office and froze. Her nameplate was gone. A different name was on her door. Someone else had moved in. She could see their things through the window. Now the panic came fast. Her first thought was that she was fired. But she worked for this company for 20 years. They wouldn't do that to her. Maybe she got off on the wrong floor. She went back to the lobby. She was on the right floor. The directory listed her name, but in a different department, in a different part of the building. She walked to her new office and her name was on the door. Her pictures were on the desk. Her sister, her parents, her favorite coffee mug was there. Her diploma's on the wall, but she didn't recognize the room. A man walked in like everything was fine. He asked about the Hernandez proposal. Apparently that was a project she'd been working on for months, and this man was her boss? Larina started to feel sick. She said she needed air. Her boss looked concerned and told her to feel better. She sat in her car trying to calm down. Nothing made sense. She needed an anchor, someone who knew her and could help her figure this out. Augustine, her boyfriend. She'd been with him for months. He helped her get over a bad breakup with her ex Miguel. Augustine would know what to do. She grabbed her phone and scrolled to his name. It wasn't there. But she knew his number. She dialed and a man answered. But it wasn't Augustine. He never heard of Augustine. And he said he'd had that number for years. She looked online. Augustine's social media was gone. It was never there. Augustine didn't exist. Larina was sure she was going crazy. So she drove to the hospital and asked a psychiatrist to prove it. The doctor was patient, but she knew he didn't believe her. She told him about the sheets, the office, her boyfriend. She thought she was having a nervous breakdown or a stroke. But the hospital ran a brain scan, toxicology panel, and a full neurological workup. Nothing was off. Her brain was healthy, and her blood work was clean. The psychiatrist said it was probably just stress. He recommended she take some time off from work. On her way home, she tried Augustine again. The same strange man answered. He was less patient this time. Maybe she got one of Augustine's numbers wrong, but she didn't think so. She knew everything about him, where he lived, where he worked. She knew his son. She was just at his apartment a few nights ago for dinner. She wouldn't have had the strength to leave Miguel without Augustine. Miguel was possessive, had a temper, and could even be violent when he was drinking. She was terrified of breaking up with him, that he might come after her. But Augustine made her feel safe. Not just physically, he gave her the confidence to take her life back. She called her sister. Her sister never heard of Augustine either, though she met him dozens of times. Larina knew she sounded crazy. She sat in her car outside her building. She pulled out her wallet and checked her ID. Her license, her insurance, her registration, all of it was right. All of it was her. Whatever was happening, it wasn't happening to her, it was happening to everything around her. She made one last call, this time to a private investigator. She told him everything she knew about Augustine. The detective said he'd give her an update in a few days. Larina was still in a daze when she got to her door. She went to put her key in the lock, and the door pushed open. The TV was on, and something was cooking. She walked down the hall, not sure what to expect. Then she smelled cologne, a familiar smell. When she got to her living room, Miguel was sitting on the couch smiling. He looked up and said, "Hey, babe." Convincing Miguel everything was okay wasn't easy. The hospital paperwork didn't. She didn't tell him she wasn't his girlfriend. She didn't tell him she remembered leaving him. She ate dinner and slept next to him. She waited for something to tell her which of these two lives was real. Then she decided to check the rest of the world. The elections happened when she remembered them. Sports results matched. News, politics, celebrity scandals, all that lined up with the world she remembered. The world was the same. Her life was different. So she started making lists of everything that was wrong. Her sister had a shoulder operation a couple of months back. Lorena remembered driving her to the hospital, visiting her with Augustine, sitting with her afterward. Her family had no memory of any operation. Her sister's shoulder had never been touched. And then there were the photographs. She found a box and went through them one at a time. She was half looking for proof and half hoping not to find any. Most of the pictures she knew, birthdays, holidays, faces she could name. And then one she couldn't. She was at an outdoor music festival in August, smiling, standing next to a famous blues guitarist. But she remembered that weekend because it was her birthday. She was with her family in the city, not at a music festival. She found pictures from New Year's Eve. She was with friends at the beach. But Lorena remembered that night perfectly. She was at home in Madrid. She remembered the meal. She remembered the wine. She remembered who was with her. Augustine, the man no one else could remember. Not even the private investigator can find him. He ran every database in the country. No birth certificate or driver's license. No tax filings. No social media. He couldn't find a single witness who ever met the man. He told her in his entire career, he never failed to find someone. Then he handed her the file and told her gently that the man she described had never been born. The man she loved for months was now just another item on a growing list of memories that never happened. Once her list passed 100 items, she started reading about time slips, deja vu, and double memory. Then she found a post on a science site about multiple universes. She finally had a name for what she was experiencing. So she left a comment with her real name and email. She said, "Hello, my name is Lorena. I am 41 years old, and I think I jumped into a parallel universe. If anyone has a similar experience, please write me an email." And the emails came flooding in. On July 16th, 2008, with Miguel asleep in the next room, she opened her laptop and posted her story online. She knew people would call her insane, but she didn't care anymore. Within hours, she got hundreds of replies. Most said she was crazy or lying, but a few believed her. Strangers from a dozen countries described their own versions. A woman who came home one night to find the wallpaper in her hallway had changed. A man who remembered her sister he never had. A teacher who didn't recognize people in her own wedding photo. A father who looked at his son's report card and saw a name that was almost his son's, but not quite. She answered messages for 2 years. She kept her email active and the post visible. She responded politely to people who called her insane, a witch, or a liar. Some people called her a grifter, but she never gave a single interview. She never wrote a book. She never made a dollar from her story. She wondered if none of this was real. Maybe we're all characters inside something, a game or a simulation. Maybe whoever was running her simulation hit a glitch and saved her into the wrong life. She said she was tired. Part of her wanted to believe she was stuck in a very long dream, and she just wanted to wake up. Then she stopped writing, and Lorena Garcia Gordo was never heard from again. Lorena's email is gone, but her post is still online. You can read it in the original Spanish. You can read almost 20 years of replies. Lorena would be in her late 50s now, sleeping next to a man she didn't choose, working a job she didn't want, walking past photos of vacations she didn't take. Some say that's what deja vu is, a small update to your file. Maybe Lorena was right. Maybe she got saved into the wrong life and nobody noticed but her. And if it happened to her, it could happen to anyone. If your whole life rewrote itself overnight, you couldn't prove it. Your ID would say you belong right where you woke up. Your family would say you're confused. Your friends would worry you lost your mind. Every record in the world would line up against you. Think about the last time you talked to an old friend. They had memories of you that you forgot. Things you said, things you did, that didn't sound familiar. Sometimes the person they're describing doesn't sound like you at all. And maybe that's because it's not. Gather round. This happened in Riverside, California in 2006. Carol pulled off the highway, turned onto her grandmother's street, and stopped the car. Her grandmother's old Tudor house was gone. So were the giant eucalyptus trees that were in front of the house forever. Her aunt and uncle lived next door, and their house was gone too. Instead, there were different homes. Not new construction, lived in for years. Lived in by strangers. But Carol would soon realize the only stranger here was her. In March 2006, Carol McKelleny left her home in San Bernardino, California with her sheepdog Sandy. Sandy was competing in a dog show in Paris about an hour south. About halfway through the trip, she saw a familiar exit, Riverside. She grew up there. Most of her family still lived there. She had plenty of extra time, so she decided to stop and visit her grandparents' graves. As soon as the thought entered her mind, she smelled cigars. But she didn't smoke. Nobody ever smoked in her car. Her windows were all the way up because of the rain. She checked the dashboard vents. Closed. She looked around and checked the rearview mirror. Nobody for miles. Sandy was curled up in the back seat, asleep. Nothing in her car smelled like cigars. But the smell was thick and heavy. It was definitely cigar smoke, and it was familiar. She remembered that her grandfather used to smoke cigars. He died when she was 5 years old. His cigars were the only thing she actually remembered about him. Just the smell. This smell. And now, all these years later, that smell was back. She got off the exit and headed toward her old neighborhood. Slowly, the cigar smell faded. She knew that smells create powerful memories. She figured thinking about her grandfather probably brought that memory back. She drove to her old house first, the one she lived in for a few years after college. She stopped the car in front of the house, at least where the house used to be. Right street, right address, but her house wasn't there. Not a single house on the street looked familiar. So she drove to her grandmother's house next, right around the corner. Once again, she was at the right address, but her grandmother's house was gone. Her aunt and uncle lived right next door. Their house was gone too. Right street, right numbers. But again, different houses sat exactly where her family's homes had stood her entire life. Carol McKelleny couldn't get lost in Riverside if she tried. Her family settled in the city in the early 1800s. She visited as a baby. She spent her childhood summers there. She lived there after college. This wasn't a town she just passed through. This was her family's home. She could navigate these streets with her eyes closed. But as she drove that neighborhood, none of the houses were right. It was as if the entire neighborhood was replaced. All of it. Obviously, a few homes would change over the years, but not all of them. Besides, these homes weren't new. They were old. Carol needed proof that she wasn't losing her mind. There was a place she knew well not far from here, and it couldn't be repainted or rebuilt. It couldn't be paved over. She drove over to the cemetery. Carol knew the cemetery well. She'd been there dozens of times. She knew the ornate iron fence at the main gate, the long gravel driveway, and the specific spot where her grandparents were buried. She stopped the car at the entrance, but it wasn't an entrance to a cemetery. There was no cemetery, just a rusty chain-link fence around a dirt lot. There was no sign, no way in or out, just dirt, scattered trash, and weeds. You can rebuild an entire block, maybe even an entire neighborhood. That was unlikely, but Carol knew it was possible. But not a cemetery. You don't make a cemetery disappear. Certainly not in the few months since she was here last. That's when Carol realized everything was too quiet. The rain was still coming down, but she couldn't hear it. She couldn't hear anything outside. No rain or wind, not even the sound of traffic. Now that she thought about it, there was no traffic. She hadn't seen a single car since she left the highway. She hadn't seen any people either. Carol turned on the car radio to check the news, but all she heard was static. Across the dial, AM, FM, no matter where she tuned, she only heard static. She turned off the radio when she heard Sandy whine quietly behind her. Her dog usually loves sticking his nose near the window. Not this time. He was pressed hard against the floorboards, shaking. She pulled away from the empty lot, desperate to find anything familiar. The local middle school looked correct. Riverside City College looked correct. But nothing else did. And still, there wasn't a single person anywhere. She turned onto Riverside's main street, University Avenue. This is where most of Riverside's restaurants, banks, and shops were. The Mission Inn Hotel looked like a castle and took up an entire city block. The hotel was built in 1876 and was the heart of the city. But University Avenue was deserted. The buildings were run down and covered in graffiti. And the Mission Inn was gone. It wasn't boarded up. It wasn't renovated. It didn't exist. Carol suddenly had an understanding that she couldn't describe. She could only feel it. This was not Riverside. It was built like Riverside, named Riverside, laid out street for street like Riverside, but this place, whatever this was somewhere or something else. She kept driving, hoping to break the illusion, but it only got worse. Trees were the wrong size. Stores she knew since she was a kid were missing. Then she noticed the light outside looked unnatural. It was flat and gray, and she couldn't see any shadows. She kept driving slowly, but the urge to get out of there was getting stronger. Then, up ahead, she saw people. A small group stood at a street corner. She pulled over to take a look. She was afraid of them, but couldn't explain why. There was something about them that felt unnatural. They had two arms and two legs and looked like people, but their proportions were off. But she couldn't tell what proportions, just like something wasn't right. Then they moved, and it was like they were moving in an old film, like a slow stutter, as if the whole world's frame rate was too slow. These weren't exactly people. They were something wearing the shape of people. Even though Carol would love to ask someone about the town, she knew these were not the people to ask. She knew it deep in her soul that if she spoke to whatever was on that corner, she would not come back. She was never more sure of anything in her life. Then one of the things started turning its head. She didn't know if it was turning to look at her. She didn't wait to find out. She double-checked that the windows were all the way up and the doors were locked. Then she got out of there as fast as she could. She didn't stop for gas, didn't stop for food, she didn't stop for red lights. She definitely didn't look in the mirror. She drove as fast as she could until she saw the freeway entrance. Just like the town, the freeway looked empty, but she had no choice. She got on the freeway to head back home. She just hoped that when she got to her house, that the house was actually hers. The freeway changed everything. The moment she hit the on-ramp, sound returned. Rain, tires, traffic. The radio caught a station in the middle of a song. In the back seat, Sandy stopped shaking, sat up, and put his nose to the window like nothing happened. She drove home a little too fast, but it was worth it. Everything was as she remembered it. Her neighborhood, her house, her furniture, everything was normal. And for a long time, she didn't tell anyone what happened. She couldn't describe it. Then she learned about the many worlds theory. The theory says infinite parallel universes exist right alongside ours, separated only by vibrational frequencies. And sometimes these universes can collide or overlap, causing a rift. And when people get caught in a rift, they could end up in another place or another time, or another version of their own universe. Carol said it still felt like she was in Riverside in the right year, but on a different timeline. Carol stayed away from Riverside for a while. She tried to forget about the cigar smoke, an empty lot, and all the houses out of place. Most of all, she tried to forget about the people who weren't people standing on that corner. Then her father died. He was going to be buried in the Riverside Cemetery, next to her grandparents, in the family plot. Or so she hoped. Carol drove down for the funeral. She was on the edge her entire trip. The last time she set foot in that city was the afternoon where her reality broke. She held her breath and pulled up to the spot. The cemetery was there. The iron gate, the gravel driveway, the rows of headstones, exactly where she remembered them. Her grandparents were resting where they always were. Her father went into the ground right beside them. After the service, the family went to lunch. They ate at the Mission Inn, the hotel that looked like a castle, taking up an entire city block, just like it had since 1876. After lunch, Carol drove past her grandmother's old street. The big Tudor house was there. The towering eucalyptus trees were there, and her aunt's house was right next door. Carol asked her cousin if the houses on the block had ever changed. They looked at her like she was crazy. Those houses never changed. They never burned down. They were built before Carol was even born. The city was the city. There was no version of Riverside where the Mission Inn was gone. There was no version of Riverside where the cemetery was just a dirt lot. Except for the version Carol drove through one rainy afternoon in 2006. She finally started telling her story, though she can't explain what caused it. She didn't see lights in the sky. She wasn't abducted. She didn't experience missing time. And she returned to Riverside many times over the years. Every visit, the streets were correct. The buildings were real. Everything was exactly as it should be. Except there's one place she avoids. She never went back to that corner where the people, not people, were standing. And she's pretty sure that they're not there on that corner. But she doesn't want to find out what happens if she's wrong. Gather round. This happened in Richmond Hill, Georgia in August of 2004. At 5 in the morning, a Burger King employee carried a bag of trash to the dumpster. There was a man on the ground. He had long matted hair and a beard down to his waist. He was naked, sunburned, and covered in fire ant bites. He was still alive, but just barely. She dropped the trash, ran inside, and called 911. When the paramedics rolled him onto the stretcher, he opened his eyes and tried to speak. He couldn't remember his name. He couldn't remember his birthday. He couldn't remember a single day of his life. He didn't know it yet, but on paper, he didn't exist. Not for the last 21 years. The hospital admitted him as a John Doe. The intake nurse needed something to write on the chart. She wrote down where they found him. Burger King. Burger King Doe. BK Doe. For weeks, the hospital tried to identify him. They ran his fingerprints. They checked missing persons databases. They circulated his photograph. Nothing. His blood came back clean. No drugs, no alcohol. His vitals and reflexes were normal. He could talk. He could read. He could tell you who the president was. He just didn't know who he was. The doctors found three depressions in his skull. Blunt force trauma from a long time ago. He didn't remember the injury. He had cataracts on both eyes so thick he was nearly blind. He didn't remember that either. He told them what he could remember. A monument in Indianapolis, a cemetery, a mall in Boulder, Colorado, a river, a college library with long tables. He remembered two or three brothers. Not their names, just the fact that he had them. The doctors thought he was lying, so they tested him. Spelling, vocabulary, math. He passed everything. He knew the capitals of every state. He knew the rules of poker, how to bone a chicken, how to fix a carburetor, the lyrics to every song from the 60s. When the cafeteria handed him a tray, he prepped a sandwich like a short order cook. He didn't think about it for a second. The skills were intact. The man who learned them was gone. The hospital kept him for 2 weeks. Then they needed the bed. But to discharge someone, the system needs a name. So he gave himself one. He chose Benjamin with two A's and Kyle. From the initials they'd been writing on his charts, BK, Benjamin Kyle. Then Benjamin moved into a local shelter. About 9 months later, surgeons removed his cataracts. The bandages came off, he looked into a mirror and didn't recognize the man looking back. He thought he was about 40. The man in the mirror was almost 60. It was like he closed his eyes and woke up 21 years later. For the next 11 years, Benjamin Kyle legally didn't exist. The FBI ran his fingerprints, no match. Interpol ran him internationally and found nothing. The U.S. Marshals Service searched every cold case file they had. The Social Security Administration couldn't give him a number without proving his birth. He couldn't prove his birth without having a name. He couldn't get a name without proving his birth. He legally couldn't rent an apartment. He couldn't hold a job, open a bank account. He couldn't get a library card. He couldn't vote, couldn't drive, couldn't get on a plane. He couldn't see a doctor without paying cash. As far as the United States government was concerned, the man behind the Burger King was never born. He went on Dr. Phil, he went on CNN, Anderson Cooper. National Geographic ran a feature with his photo on their homepage. The Today Show ran his case three times. Tens of millions of people saw his face, and the whole country was rooting for him. But nobody called. He took odd jobs that paid in cash, washing dishes, sweeping floors, cooking at a barbecue joint where the owner didn't ask questions. He slept in shelters, on couches, under bridges when the shelters were full. The press called him the last unknown man in America. But 11 years later, his DNA found him. A genetic genealogist saw his case on television and couldn't let it go. She ran his DNA against every public ancestry database she could find. For 4 years, she found cousins, distant ones, then closer ones, then a half-sister. In the fall of 2015, she called him. He had a name, William Burgess Powell, born August 29, 1948, in Lafayette, Indiana. His family told him what they remembered. William grew up in Lafayette. He left a hard home at 16 and moved in with a host family down the road. He ate dinner at their table every single night through high school and into adulthood. Then one night in 1976, he didn't show up for dinner. The host family walked over to his trailer to check on him. The door was unlocked. The lights were off. His stereo, his tools, his books, all sitting right where he left them. The bed was made. A few days later, his car turned up abandoned a few miles down the road near a dam. Doors locked. No note, no blood, no sign of a struggle. His brother reported him missing, but that was 1976. By now, his family assumed he was dead. But the family wanted to take him home, to the actual house he grew up in. They drove him out to Lafayette and walked him up the steps to the front door, and then he stopped. He looked into the house, then he turned around and walked back to the car. He never set foot inside. There was a reason William Powell disappeared, and he never wanted to be found. A reporter started digging into the years before the dumpster. He pulled the missing persons report that the family filed in 1976, and it told a story that wasn't told on Dr. Phil or NPR. It was a story that the FBI had never heard. In March 1976, William Powell was working at a convenience store in Lafayette, Indiana. He was 27 years old. He had a co-worker named Charles Getz, who went by Chico. One night, in the middle of the night, Powell and Chico drove out of Lafayette and they kept driving. They drove all night and all the next day. They stopped in Boulder, Colorado. State police later found his car abandoned on the side of the road. His keys were gone. The trailer he'd been living in was empty, and the license plates were removed. He didn't take a wrong turn. He didn't break down. He didn't get lost. He just took his license plates and walked away. The Social Security earnings record for William Burgess Powell shows activity through 1983. After that, nothing. No employer, no tax filing, no address, no bank account, no traffic ticket, no hospital records. For 21 years, there is no William Powell anywhere in the United States. Then a Burger King employee in Georgia goes to take the trash out. In May of 2026, a documentary crew released a series about the case. They worked on it for years, trying to figure out what filled the gap. They didn't find proof of anything, but they found enough to make people start asking different questions. They claim they recovered a computer Powell used that was forensically wiped, the kind of wipe that takes specialized software. They claim that recovery tools turned up searches of his real name, and he was searching for Colorado cold case murder files. They found emails that he'd been spoofing to look like they were coming from someone else. They tracked down Chico Getz, the man who drove west with Powell in 1976. Getz agreed to talk to them briefly. He said he was afraid of Powell, and he wouldn't say any more. They say Powell worked for organized crime in Lafayette before he left. They call this a rumor. The name of the organization is bleeped throughout the series. There are no charges. There are no arrests. There's no evidence, anyone has produced in public. But when the documentary came out in May, Powell wasn't around to respond to it. Around December of 2016, William Powell disappeared again. He went off-grid, he stopped using his name, and he stopped appearing on any record anywhere. Only now, he knows who he is. The same doctor who diagnosed him way back in the beginning thought he was faking the entire time. That's on the record. And it's possible that that doctor was right. What nobody argues about is the hole in the middle. 21 years, 1983 to 2004. A stretch where William Powell simply isn't anywhere. No job, no address, no record. Not one witness who can place him. He never got those years back. Or he never lost them. He would be 77 years old now, and nobody knows where he is. And that's exactly how William Powell, aka Benjamin Kyle, wants it. The man who forgot his whole life probably remembered everything. He just made sure the rest of us never knew it.
Thank you so much for hanging out today. My name is AJ. This is The Y-Files, and that was a campfire story. No debunking, no analysis, just a creepy story to scare you and the kids. And that one is true and unsolved. Now, if you had fun, I'd appreciate it if you can like, subscribe, comment, and share. That stuff really helps. And like most topics we cover here, today's was recommended by you. So if there's a story you'd like to see, go to thewyfiles.com/tips or send us an email. We'd love to cover that story. And if you'd like to hear any of these campfire stories expanded into a full episode, there's a few I'd like to do, then definitely let me know. Remember, The Y-Files is also a podcast. You can take us on the road. I post deep dives into the stories we cover on the channel. I also post episodes that wouldn't be allowed on the channel. The podcast is called The Y-Files, Operation Podcast, and it's available everywhere. And if you're listening on an audio platform, do me a favor, hit the thumbs up or the like or the follow or whatever those buttons are. Those really do help. Now, if you need more Y-Files in your life, check out our Discord. We're about to hit 100,000 members over there. It's a lot of fun. It's a really supportive community. There's someone on there 24/7, and it's free to join. Speaking of 24/7, check out our 24/7. I'm plowing through the plugs. Speaking of 24/7, make sure you check out our 24/7 stream in the Y-Files backstage. Over there, we run episodes back-to-back with some fun content in between, and the live chat is super, super fun. Special thanks to our patrons who make this channel possible and make every episode of The Y-Files happen. Every episode is dedicated to our Patreon members. I could not do this without you. And if you'd like to support the channel, keep us going, consider becoming a member on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, get access to perks like videos early with no commercials, exclusive merch, and 2 private live streams every week just for you to hear the whistle in my teeth. It's because I'm going too fast. The private live streams are a lot of fun for members only. My webcam is on. Everyone on the team has their camera on. You can talk to all of us. Turn your camera on, jump up on stage, ask a question. I think it's the best perk there is. Another great way to support the channel, grab something from the Y-Files store. That is shop@thewyfiles.com. You'll find it. But if you're going to buy merch, become a member on YouTube. YouTube members get 10% off everything in the Y-Files store forever. So if you're going to spend $40 on t-shirts and festival mugs, become a member on YouTube for $3. Pays for itself. And that money goes to the team, not to me. Those are the plugs. I got through them as fast as I could. And that's going to do it. Till next time, be safe, be kind, and know that you are appreciated.
In Area 51, a secret code inside the Bible said I was. I love my UFOs and paranormal fun, as well as music, so I'm singing it like I should. But then another conspiracy theory becomes the truth, my friends, and it never ends. No, it never ends. I got stuck inside Mel's home with MK Ultra. I've been only too aware. Did Stanley Kubrick fake the moon landing alone on a film set? Or were the shadow people there? The Roswell aliens just fought the smiling man, I'm told. And his name was Cold. And I can't believe I'm dancing with the fishes.
and the solar storm still come to a god that the secret city underground. Mysterious number stations, planet Serpo 2, Project Stargate, and what the Dark Watchers found.
In a simulation, don't you worry though.
The Black Knight satellite, it told me so. I can't believe I'm dancing with the fish. Head for fish on Thursday nights with AJ2 and the weapons on the beat all through the night. All I ever wanted was to just hear the truth. So the weapons on the beat all through the night. Head for fish on Thursday nights with AJ2 and the weapons on the beat all through the night. All I ever wanted was to just hear the truth. So the weapons.
Camel.